This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manitou Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Owen Dolan,
Roger Mann,
Alison Molden,
and I am Stuart Burks.
Okay, now Owen, we've heard about your childhood and then you went on to train for the priesthood, but you also spent 25 years as a bishop in Palmerston North. And when did that start?
That started, I was made a bishop in 1995. At that stage, I was a priest of what the district or the diocese is the word of Wellington, out of which Palmerston North was made a separate diocese in 1980. But I was in the Wellington part when it happened, and so I was continued on in Wellington. I had various roles there. I had just returned about that time from some years working in Peru. And I was then in charge of the parish in Stokes Valley. And then Cardinal Tom Williams had just been made the Archbishop of Wellington, and he asked me to be his offsider, Vicar General is the term, as you might say, the number two or something. And so I had that role for 10 years until the 1991. And then in 1991, I was the National New Zealand Director of Overseas Catholic Missions, which meant that I was promoting mission support for, you know, overseas countries and money raising for the missions, that sort of thing.
Is that because you spent time in Peru?
Possibly, I suppose, because I had already had a bit of a missionary experience myself. I suppose that came into it, of course.
So your time in Peru, you would have been considered a missionary?
Yes.
So how did that, you volunteered for that?
Volunteered for that. I'd always been interested, in fact, you know, going back to the time of thinking about priesthood, I would have wished at that stage to join a missionary order. But because of my recent history at that time, which I described before with this rheumatic fever and stuff, it wasn't fitting. But then after some years, and we were given the opportunity to volunteer for a term overseas if we wished, and so I applied for that and got it, so I went to South America.
Is that a 1 year or a 3 year?
No, it was a 5 year
term. Five years.
So I was in Peru, and that was then when I came back, as I said then, to Stokes Valley, actually it was.
Okay, so then you then moved to Palmerston North in 19...
The end of 1995, I was made a bishop to assist Bishop Peter Cullimane here, who had a very, very serious illness, and I was, I suppose you'd describe as his assistant bishop. He is still alive and is in better health than he was, but, you know, he had that period of not good health at all for quite some years.
So
we're the pair of us, but we're both retired now. We have a new younger bishop, of course.
So how was the role of bishop compared to your earlier roles?
Well, it was more or less, of course, sort of administrative and all the rest of it. And in our theology, there are certain roles that a bishop can perform, for instance, like confirmation of young people, or ordination of another young priest, that sort of thing, and other things that are reserved to bishops in the Catholic way. And so I, you know, have done a lot of that sort of thing, well, before I retired.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and you're also as one of the leading people in the local church.
Well, yes, although not so much now because I've withdrawn from a lot of those sorts of roles. But then you were sort of on administrative committees and so on. Yeah. And there's a conference of Catholic bishops because there are six jurisdictions, I suppose would be a good word to use, in the Catholic Church in New Zealand, and you meet in from time to time.
So how many bishops would
there? Well, at present, because of the retired ones also, so there's six bishops who are in charge of their diocese, but then there's probably four or five of us who have been active bishops and now retired.
Ah, so you're always a bishop once you...
Yes. It's what we would call in the Catholic Church a sacramental role, so that, it's permanent.
So in your work then, is there a sort of a strategy or policy dimension to that?
Well, yes, it's very much, of course, to know and pass on the teachings of the Catholic Church and administrative too. Now, latterly, as one must know, there's been some very, very bad, sad things happened at the role of bishops in the Universal Catholic Church too. Which we're all sadly very much aware of, embarrassed about, humiliated by, angry about, all those things, of course. So those things have to be faced, and hopefully solutions or policies made that nullify, undo those sorts of things, which, of course, will be easier said than done. Change in the church, I suppose, in any church or any religion, but it's certainly in our case, happen, but happen very, very slowly. A big universal church like ours, and we try to be as unified as possible. Absolutely. But then you take into account that everybody's different cultures, for instance. I mean, as I say, Latin America, which is 40% of the Catholic Church anyway, has got culture and background and all the rest of it. And the basic teachings, of course, are constant. Ways of expressing our faith and religion and all the rest of it can differ with the cultural background of the people. And so it's a pretty widespread sort of a role.
Yeah. Would you say then there's something distinctive about the Catholic Church here?
I don't know how distinctive. I don't know whether that's the word we're about. Perhaps at the most 15% of the population, which is quite low compared with a lot of other places, like Australia would be probably 25%. And that depends, I think, on the who came here in the first place. And it was mainly, from the UK, from those areas. There was an Irish component too, of course. But, we've got English, Scottish, Welsh, Irish. And then in regard to the Catholic thing too, added to by Polish, say, and then since the Second World War, and in recent times, a lot of Pacificus, because the Catholic Church was fairly strong, is still fairly strong in the Pacific Islands, and Vietnam, Asia, South Korea, there's been quite a spread in recent times.
Did you have many Maori in
there? Not too many Maori. The Maori mission thing was a big thing. And we had a Maori bishop, but he hasn't been replaced. Not that there's any antipathy, of course.
Specifically as a Maori bishop, he was a Maori who was a bishop?
He was both those things. He was made an auxiliary bishop of Hamilton Diocese, but his role then was mainly, almost entirely, with the Maori population throughout the whole of the country, not just in that area, that diocese that he came from.
Okay, and now you talked about the religious side, but obviously the Catholic schools.
Yes.
I'm thinking more of the Catholic Church and its involvement in the community itself. Was it mainly Catholics going to Catholic schools?
Yes, it would have been, was, is, perhaps, and is, I'd say, still. Yeah. But with the schools now being integrated into the whole New Zealand system, there is also a role where a certain percentage needn't be Catholics. Yes. The priority agreed by the government is for the Catholic children who want to go. But if there's still spaces and all the rest of it, you don't turn people down. So there's probably up to 5, perhaps 10% of people who are not Catholic in our schools, or higher than that, I'd say, in some areas.
And most Catholics would send their children to a Catholic school?
Yes, when they do, in the main. And other people want to send them to the school too, not so much because of they claim, and that's nice to know, if they say, because of the values.
Yeah.
The
discipline?
Well, yes, although the discipline wouldn't think much different. I don't know. I don't think so. The discipline's pretty much even, I think, about it. I don't know. I think we mentioned that when we were talking about primary before. I hadn't quite thought of that, nor do I perhaps see it so strongly, that discipline, or that type, or a type of discipline that was a hallmark. Hopefully there is a discipline in all schools as far as that goes, far as behaviour and respect and courtesy and non-bullying, all those sorts of things.
I think that there was, tradition might be the wrong word, but the idea of physical discipline, maybe in all schools, but certainly in Catholic schools.
Now
that's no longer permitted.
It's not an impact. I see there's a perception of that. That's interesting. I'm not just denying that it could be true, but I hadn't quite realised it. Yes. Okay.
To what extent then was religion part of the education in Catholic schools?
Well, the teachers were in the main Catholic, and we would of course have religious education classes, and we had opportunities for celebrating and practicing Catholic things, especially the Mass is the centre of our Catholic worship, really. It's our main worship thing. And other ceremonies too. And as a preparation also, it's usually at secondary school age, for the sacrament of confirmation, which is a sort of another stage into the Catholic thing, you might say.
And that happens at what age is it?
Say teenage.
Okay.
Yes, 14, 15, whatever, that sort of thing. And we seem to have, and I'm delighted about that, is it true? But we haven't got it on our own. I'm not saying that, we're better or anything than anybody else, because that's not the case at all. But we certainly do have a reputation, I think, for perhaps a values thing, and if that's the case, well, I'm delighted. But then lots and lots of other schools would have exactly the same values. We're not unique in that.
You had a debutante balls too, didn't you?
Oh, once upon a time they did too, yes.
Yeah. In your day?
Well, not in my day, no. Certainly not in my day. That's back in the 40s. But in 80s, when I was acting parish priest of Fielding, 1967, I remember there was what we called a debutante charity ball here in Palmerston, and there were some of the Fielding, but they were usually slightly older than secondary school kids. They were 18s and 19s and 20s rather than, say, seventh formers in those days. I think it might be a bit younger now. Well, there are college balls these days, aren't there? School balls, aren't there?
Yeah, and they're presented to the
Archbishop in this case, yes.
So you...
I remember that one in Fielding, because we came into it and
right.
went home. And I backed into a telegraph pole in the parking area of our old presbytery. That's how I remember it, rather than the ball itself.
And what did you say when that happened?
I'm not going to repeat that.
Well,
so
that would have been at the time of a lot of the certainly in Europe, major social change with the Beatles and the Stones and the social unrest and the 68 student protests and so on. Did you notice much of that wave happening here, or was it more conservative?
I don't. You see, I was, well, if we were talking about things like music, just to take that one, because you quoted the Beatles, I was brought up Silver String, the Hit Parade, at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons in the common room after lunch. I was brought up on Bing Crosby, the Andrews Sisters, a new wonderful vocalist who turned out to be a guy called, his name wasn't given for a while, turned out to be a guy called Frank Sinatra. That was my era. And the big band era, Harry James, yeah. Benny Goodman, that was my era. So that all these things that happened since were a little bit sort of not quite in the same league, you know, we bit snooty. Well, they, I mean, and you learnt them and they stayed. I mean, yeah. Take the Beatles, for instance.
Yeah.
But my era was of really sold
the
on
fake
music was the big band era.
Edmundo Ross and his...
Well, that's a, yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so it's there's a lot to explore there, but I'm thinking more like your time as a bishop in Palmerston North. Were there any sort of notable events or things that stand out in that?
Well, here, yes, no, the normal things, but I think that probably the notable things were the visits overseas. To, for instance, all the bishops, we had a big, what we called a synod of Oceania in Rome with Pope John Paul II, it was in those days. Those were very important features for me as a bishop that's out of Palmerston, admittedly. And as recently as just 2 years ago, because I have still got a couple of roles at national level to meet Pope Francis and twice, actually, in a meeting in Rome that was exactly just over 2 years ago. So those things have been very important. I, because of being on the missions, and then Caritas is the Catholic Overseas Aid Agency, and Justice and Peace, all those things, and I was sort of the Caritas bishop for quite some years, sort of the liaison with the bishops' conference. And so in regard to that, I had a lot of meetings overseas, annual meetings. It's in Rome. And so I've had a wonderful opportunity to visit. And I've been back to South America a couple of times. On October the 14th, there will be the canonization, in other words, officially described as saint, of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was the Archbishop of San Salvador and who was assassinated in 1980, and I've been back there a couple of times, and that's been very important for me to have been those places. And I've actually celebrated Mass at the altar in the convent chapel where he was actually assassinated. That's those sort of events are pretty important to me.
As you mentioned it, what were the circumstances of the assassination?
Well, it was a country, well, sadly, I think, to a great extent, is, you know, they call it the Quattrocento Familia, the 14 families, you know, this is the Latin American thing, sadly, you know, who own the import-export businesses, the airline, the big ranches, you name it. And then you've got the mass of the people who are pretty much neglected and very poor. And Romero, as Archbishop of San Salvador, spoke out, it was civil war time too, very much against the rich and the neglect of the poor. And of course he had enemies as a result of that. And that's what happened in the special, the military, even the day before he died, he'd said to the soldiers, the military, please, for God's sake, stop killing your own people. Because that was the sort of thing that was happening. And the next day, on the Monday afternoon, while he was celebrating Mass, the altar's quite high, and it's a chapel that's, it's longer than this room, but then outside there's some steps down, and a white Toyota pickup truck evidently came, and the guy got out, a marksman, with a gun and laid it on the bonnet of the car, and shot him as he was standing just at that side of the altar. And some of those wealthy families got out their champagne bottles because the so-and-so's dead. So anyway, he was a very good and holy and brave sort of a man. So the church, which it does from time to time for outstanding figures in some way, models or examples for us of courage or bravery or sticking to the truth in spite of, he's been now blessed, Oscar Romero, and he will be Saint Oscar Romero on October the 14th, just in a few weeks' time. Suzanne O'Bear is our nearest person to that stage.
Yes.
And we're hoping that that will happen in her case.
Jerusalem,
up the river.
Apparently brilliant with native cures.
Medicines. Yes.
So, I suppose two things. One is, has the Catholic Church, in your opinion, changed much over your involvement with it?
A lot of things have changed in the 60-odd years since. And this, I suppose the main thing would be the Second Vatican Council in 1960s was a hallmark of major change of emphasis, not in change of belief or basic doctrines, but in the way in which our faith is exercised. That was a very important, and a lot of that is still the insights and implications of that, because it's a pretty big, multi-week sort of organisation. They're still coming through, the insights. And I think that was the main thing, and perhaps the most obvious thing as far as Catholic people concerned is that, whereas, for instance, a lot of our ceremonies, and especially the Mass, which is the heart and centre of it, were all in Latin. But since those days, have been in the vernacular, so it's all in English or Latin America, Spanish. Spanish is the biggest language grouping in the Catholic Church.
Now, a lot of your description of the Catholic Church's links to Rome and so on.
Yes.
Was there a sort of New Zealand focus of the Catholic Church in New Zealand?
Well, yes. I mean, we look to Rome, of course, as we do from every part of the Catholic Church, no matter where it is. But each country is an individual country. And while the doctrines and basic practices would be the same everywhere, we have our own emphasis in that, I suppose. We're conscious of the Maori element very much. We would perhaps beat our breast a little bit in the sense that perhaps we have neglected it sometimes and not done what we should. In that respect, we live in a society which is very conscious of the Maori thing, and that has been good for the church. We are part of all a New Zealand society, and so all the things that it espouses, the good things, some of them we're not in favour of, and I think people generally know, things like euthanasia, for instance, currently. But so I think we're all New Zealanders, the bishops, the priests, although we now have, because there's a shortage of Kiwis, we have priests from, for instance, here from India and also Vietnam. Not great numbers, but they're there also. They're part of the church. These are places that perhaps we went and missionized not so terribly long ago. Yeah. Now we find that they're helping us out. So that's happening.
Yeah. Were there any sort of broad causes or issues, like you mentioned the case in South America and support for the poor in New Zealand? Are there some things that you would identify with the church pushing for?
Well, because we're a small country and a small population, and certainly among one of the better off places in the world to live and to be and all the rest of it, I think that we're hopefully conscious of the needs of our own country, but also hopefully, I don't use the word hopefully, I think surely, feel a sense of responsibility for people and places beyond our shores too, that we're in one of those countries that's in a situation to be able to look outwards in that way, especially when it comes to material help and that sort of thing.
Yeah. But internally, say, do you have a specific stance towards refugees coming to New Zealand social issues in New Zealand, sole parenthood or things like that?
Well, we would certainly have, I mean, just take, for instance, that euthanasia thing that we've got, we'd be very strong teaching on that. Refugees, we would certainly favour the country being open more to refugees, say, or people in need, than perhaps is policy, government policy, because we're, by world standards, so well off. you know, and other people are not. I mean, if we're going to be faithful to the teachings of Christ, which is what Christianity is all about anyway, not just Catholicism, but all Christian religions, well, we just have to read a page or two of the Gospels, which is Christ's teachings, to know that we have to be, we should be, reaching out to people in need, no matter who they are, where they are, and all that sort of thing. And also, I think, also less condemnatory than perhaps some people are, or than we have been in the past. I was just reading a little thing on that the other day. You know, we think about Judas. Judas is the one of our Lord's apostles who actually, betrayed him. And so you think of him as that's the end of that, hell or whatever. There's no salvation for Judas. There's an old church in Burgundy in France which has a lot of teaching stained glass, of course, that's what that was all about originally, but in sculptures and the pillars there. And I was just reading this the other day, and on one side of the pillar you've got Judas having betrayed the Lord, hanging by, he took his own life then, hanging by, on one side. And on the other side you've got Jesus the Good Shepherd with Judas on his shoulders. So that mercy is very much at the heart of the Christian faith, our faith, another Christian faith. And there's been, especially Pope Francis, has spoken very strongly and very frequently about mercy. And that's been, is, and has been, and hopefully will be, good for us. As Catholics, as hopefully anybody.
Now, also, we're just about at time, so I'm going to throw in a curly one for
great.
You. Especially as it's something that you, it's your lived experience, but a lot of people question the issue of celibacy for Catholic priests.
That's
What's your opinion on that?
Well, it's not an unchangeable thing. Why are we celibates? I mean, people will give all sorts of reasons, some of them not very positive or helpful either about it. But celibacy is something that's freely chosen, has been freely chosen. I mean, you've got 7 years of training, for instance, to, you know, at that age group too, when people are making relationships with others. And so that in the process of training and that sort of stage, you find that quite a number of people do opt out because they realise that they don't wish to be celibate and single. But so it's just a matter of where you feel the values are. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who's by any means celibate is therefore gay or whatever, because I would certainly know that that is not the case. And it certainly doesn't mean that people who are celibate and priests are not, don't have doubts or temptations in regard to their sexuality.
Yeah. But I hadn't thought of that perception or that perspective. I was thinking more, is it something that you can be a better priest because you are celibate?
I think a lot of it, from one point of view, yes, the answer is that because you're free to devote yourself to your flock and all the needs of your people, than say possibly you would be as a person who had more personal responsibilities like wife and family and children and that sort of thing. So it leaves you much more free for that aspect of life, which is a pretty important one. It's a freedom thing. It's not a limiting thing. It's meant to be a freeing thing, and that's the way it would be presented to us. It happens, of course, human beings being human beings with emotions and passions and feelings, that sometimes people who have chosen that celibacy, with knowing all those things and well educated about it as they're preparing, perhaps in due course will find that it's not the call for them. So we have priests, not great numbers, but some who have, you know, moved out of ministry because of that and married.
How are they then viewed by the church?
Mostly very positively. Golly, our diocesan staff, who are some of the leaders in the church, just down there in our place, we've got two, haven't we? Yes, on our staff, who are former priests, and there are several others that I know of, and they're very well received.
Okay.
In their wives and so on. especially, yeah, I'm just thinking particularly with one of ours, who's got a very important role just below the level of the bishop in pastoral works in the diocese.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.